I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. 9 out of 10 of the 322 murder victims in Baltimore City this year have been African American. For family and friends left behind, losing a loved one to homicide can color the grieving process with shame, blame, and stigma. Survivors may be reluctant to share what happened, fearing that people will assume the deceased was involved in criminal activity. But bottling up feelings of anger and sadness can cause post-traumatic stress disorder and other health problems. We look at homicide and grief in the African American community with Tanya Sharp of the University of Maryland School of Social Work and Kim Holmes of the Family Bereavement Center, part of the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. That's Midday after this news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you have tuned in. A serious topic today. 322 people have been murdered this year in Baltimore City, 9 out of 10 of them African American. U.S. Census data says that the rate of homicide among African Americans is more than 10 times that of whites. Each victim leaves behind family, friends, co-workers, and neighbors who must cope with this sudden and violent loss. The way they grieve is colored by shame, stigma, and blame. They may be reluctant to talk about what happened because they fear people will assume the deceased was involved in criminal activity. Survivors may also fear that losing a loved one to murder will reinforce negative stereotypes about African Americans, especially if the perpetrator was also African American. For every victim of homicide, research estimates there are 7 to 10 people deeply impacted. As we enter the holiday season and come to the end of an especially violent year, there are thousands of people who may be struggling not to get over their loss, but to get through their grief. How does stigma affect grieving? Why are grieving African Americans less likely to seek out formal sources of assistance like counseling? How does mourning a loved one lost to murder differ from mourning someone who died in some other way? What is the health impact of prolonged grief? How can community leaders learn to recognize the signs that someone should seek professional help? If you've been through this, we would love to hear from you. You can call us toll-free at 866-661-9309, or you can call us locally, 410-662-8780. Again, 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd love you to be part of this conversation. We welcome to the show Dr. Tanya Sharp. She is assistant professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work. She's conducted hundreds of interviews in several cities, including Baltimore, with African Americans who have lost loved ones to homicide. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Sharp.
Thank you, Sheila.
And also with us is Kim Holmes. Kim Holmes is a licensed clinical social worker and bereavement coordinator. She works for the Family Bereavement Center, a program of the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City. The Family Bereavement Center provides counseling and other services for family members of homicide victims. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you, Sheila.
So glad you're here. Professor Sharp, Baltimore's population is about 64% African-American, but African-Americans, as I mentioned, account for 90% of the city's murder victims. If we zoom out, what do we find at a national level?
We'll find similar traits, particularly in urban areas where there are concentrated levels of poverty, concentrated levels of disenfranchised and marginalized communities of color that don't have equal access to educational opportunities, employment opportunities, where there is limited adequate housing, poor environmental conditions. We see the same sort of trend in Chicago, New Jersey, pockets of New Orleans.
Kim Holmes, I mentioned counseling, mm-hmm. but that's only part of what the bereavement center does. Tell us what other services you provide.
Yeah, the services that we provide, we do have victims advocates who will help the family navigate the justice system by offering court support, referrals to other agencies. You know, they may need assistance with housing. They may need liaison services with the assistant state's attorney, the police department, the medical examiner's office, those such services.
Mm-hmm. And how do people find the bereavement center?
Well, there's a number of ways. First of, we send out an outreach letter that outlines our services to each family member who's lost a loved one to homicide. The detectives that are on the scene are also have out information and pass it out to the families. We also have word of mouth. A lot of family members do know about the Family Bereavement Center, and when this happens, oftentimes they call me directly or call the office directly and refer families themselves, as well as the assistant state's attorneys in the office as well that have met with families during family meetings. They will also refer families as well.
Professor Sharp, I read a few of your research papers, and the concept of complicated grieving comes up, which at first just sounds like two normal words in the English language, but it means something special when you write about it.
Yes.
Can you give us
a short
understanding of what complicated grief is?
For homicide victims or survivors of homicide victims, and in particular those in the African American community, when they experience the homicide of a loved one, it is not just a grief experience, if you will. The grief is complicated for a number of reasons. The reasons being that you are inundated by the media. Or not, which is also the case a lot of times when you have exorbitant rates of homicide violence in African American community, and their loved ones are gone unnoticed, or they appear in Section D of the newspaper, or it's treated as a sort of normal occurrence in the neighborhood. There's a lot of anger behind that, so that it complicates the way in which one travels or journeys through their grief. There's also issues of shame, blame, and stigma, and a sense of lack of justice that are also paramount. So lack of justice being, it's just another individual, especially if the case has gone unsolved, there's a feeling or a sense that there's not urgency to basically address that particular crime that happened to their loved one. The shame that goes on is also coupled with a lot of stigma and blame. The blame really comes about basically based upon the fact that individuals have told me that they believe that they were so frustrated that they couldn't protect their loved one from harm. And then the stigma comes about, which also complicates the grief, because there's a feeling or a sense that individuals are thinking, oh, it's just another black young man that was probably dealing drugs or probably involved in gang activity. And so they're in all of that. Families find themselves having to sort through and wait through the heaviness of that stigmatization, of that blame and shame, in order to navigate their way through even recognizing how grief manifests itself in their own mind and body and spirit.
Boy, that's a whole lot to unpack.
Yes,
and you've spent a lot of time thinking about it. But let me pick up that last point about stigma, because and Kim Holmes, let me get your thoughts on this too, because even if it is not meant to be dismissive, as you just described it, oh, it's just another, even if that's not the thought behind it, certainly in the community there is concern about this surge of homicides that is being visited primarily on African American neighborhoods. And so I would think would think that is part of the reaction to news of another murder is, how did it happen? What was behind it? Who was getting even with whom? Was this connected to crime? I mean, it's a conversation that the community sort of needs to have, and yet you say it complicates grieving.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take it, or do you want me to go?
Well, you know, what ends up happening a lot of times, first of all, in the black community, the African-American community, counseling has always been one of those things that people had a hard time with going to, because they...
You're talking about professional counseling.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yes, because it was already a stigma, surrounded about that, or, you know, whether or not you were crazy, whether or not you were going to be telling your family business, etc. So you already have that stigma. And then when you have the feeling of no one cares, no one is going to listen, it's just another homicide in the city, that makes people also very reluctant. And when you don't know who did it, that makes you have a lot of mistrust as well. So it keeps people, you know, from coming together a lot of times. It keeps people from seeking help, from seeking counseling, and just have this sense of hopelessness and helplessness.
Mm-hmm. I confess when I have heard about this element of stigma attaching at the time of a homicide, I've tended to think it was something that was coming from outside one's immediate group, one's family, one's friends, one's neighbors. I thought of it. Well, the media would characterize it that way, or outsiders whom you might not even know, you know, across town, across the country. And I sort of thought, well, sort of, who cares what they think? But you're telling me it comes also from close by, and from other African Americans.
Yes. So let's. I think if we actually want to parcel this out, in a real sort of informed way, we really have to look at the historical context, if you will. And so, for the African American community, when you look at our relationship with medical and mental health institutions, you know, it hasn't been pretty, so to speak. There have been a lot of misuse and misconduct relative to experimenting with African Americans, so forth and so on. So that sets the stage for a little hesitancy in terms of actually reaching out for medical mental health services. On the other hand, I also want to look at and talk about, and I talk about this in my research, and this is coming from the mouths of individuals who are surviving the homicide of a loved one, the whole idea of race-based structural inequality and how that really, really limits your not only perception, but your availability to equitable resources in terms of quality health care, access to jobs so you can afford health care. And so when you couple all of that together and you look at that in terms of how it informs stigma, you know, we're dealing with that as sort of the underbelly of why people are angry, why people are frustrated. It's a broader systemic issue that is plaguing communities that have been disenfranchised historically and contemporarily.
Let me make sure I'm getting the full import of what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Because when you talk about anger and distrust, I'm thinking the survivors who are themselves victims of this homicide don't want to access professional counseling or don't want to access some other aspect. But then you also mentioned that it's not available to them. I mean, how much, Kim Holmes, let me ask you, how much, I mean, first of all, I don't know whether the bereavement center part of the state's attorney's office can make, can essentially pay for services that survivors need, even if they don't have insurance that covers it. But to what extent is it something that's not accessible to them because of the financial burden compared to something that they aren't interested in?
Mm-hmm. Well, for some, that is correct, that it's not accessible. Fortunately, at the Family Bereavement Center, we're a grant-funded program and we are free. Our services are free. And so we do work very hard to make sure that those families that want it and need counseling access our services. And those that can't, for whatever reason, whether it's transportation, whether it's because they have families and they can't come to us, then we make sure we link them up with services that are available to them in their communities.
Professor Sharp, I thought you were about to say something.
No.
Okay. We just heard from Kim Holmes, licensed clinical social worker and bereavement coordinator at the Family Bereavement Center, a program in the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City. And also here is Tanya Sharp, assistant professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work, who has conducted hundreds of interviews in several cities, including Baltimore, with African Americans who have lost loved ones to homicide. And we'd like to include you in this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We have a caller, Michelle from Baltimore. Michelle, welcome to Midday. Michelle?
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
So what is your comment or question?
Basically, I just wanted to say that I am a mom and I lost my only son, Wesley Lewis, and August 2014. He was murdered in Baltimore City.
Oh,
and
I'm
I just
so
wanted
sorry.
To say that the Family Bereavement Center has given me a lot of support, and I'm just very grateful for the Family Bereavement Center.
I appreciate your calling, Michelle. Thank you, and I'm really sorry about what you're going through. What have you found most helpful from the Family Bereavement Center?
That the therapist that I'm currently seeing, Ms. Kim is very helpful. She's just receiving the tools that I need to just to continue to go on and not to give up.
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful statement, Michelle. I can tell it's that you're working hard at this. I hope it goes well. Professor Sharp, I mentioned 7 or 10 people mm-hmm. is the estimate of how many survivors are left behind. So in Baltimore, that means there must be literally thousands.
Absolutely.
Of people who are at some point in, we talk about a grieving process. I'm not sure it really is a process.
Mm. It's a journey.
Okay. What kind of effect does that have on the shared life in Baltimore?
Absolutely.
On the community?
Yeah, and it's an epidemic, certainly. We are certainly overwhelmed by this. How that translates for community grief in particular, you have less community cohesion, where people are actually interacting with one another, trusting one another, going neighbor to neighbor, having the block parties type of thing. People are very, very suspect. You have a lot of hypervigilance, which goes on. So people are very alert and aware of their surroundings not less trusting of their neighbor and doing sort of neighborly acts. You have anger that's certainly pent up anger and not really knowing what to do with it. So those are some really challenges that our individuals are facing when they go to their jobs. When we talk about young children trying to sit down and pass a test going to school. So we're seeing, exorbitant rates of young children being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or being labeled as aggressive. Those kinds of things. And really, it's all the manifestation of trauma going unchecked, going unnoticed, if you will.
That is Professor Tanya Sharp from the University of Maryland School of Social Work here on Midday on WIPR. Also with us is Kim Holmes of the Bereavement Center in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to take a short break here. We'll be back to continue this conversation, and we hope that you will be part of it. You can send us an email at midday@wipr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the devastation homicide inflicts on the African-American community and how to address that. Here with me is Associate Professor Tanya Sharp of the University of Maryland School of Social Work and Kim Holmes, a licensed clinical social worker and bereavement coordinator who works for the Family Bereavement Center out of the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City. Did you lose a loved one to homicide? If so, were you reluctant to talk about what happened? What helped you honor their memory? You can tell us about this if you give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at wypr.org. Kim Holmes, I'm thinking of the people who are in touch with the Bereavement Center, obviously have been touched probably when they first contact you fairly suddenly by homicide, but they've chosen to come to you. Are they reluctant to talk about it even though they've reached out to you?
Generally, the ones who come on their own are not reluctant. They feel like they need to be able to talk about it. They talk about it amongst their families. They talk about it amongst their friends. They're essentially grieving together. So essentially they are having a hard time with helping each other. So they end up coming to the Family Bereavement Center because most of the people that I deal with have had a loss at some point in their life, but they realize that this is different. This feels different. Mm-hmm. And it often has a sense of I'm losing my mind. Mm-hmm. And so they come to me in order to make sense of what happens. The two common themes I generally hear is why. Why did this happen? And then the other theme that I often hear is, you know, am I going to be able to get through this? Okay. And it's really tough for a lot of families, particularly around this time of the year. Mm-hmm. And generally what I also say to family members that the toughest time is generally the first year. Now, that doesn't mean that the second year is going to be a piece of cake and the third year either. It just means that you're going to go through the first of everything. You know, whether if they celebrate any type of holidays or special moments, it'll be the first time that they have to go through that without their loved one. Yeah. So it really is about learning how to live with this. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no, in my opinion, there's no such thing about getting over it. It really is about trying to get through it one day at a time.
Yeah. Well, the questions that you just reported that are so common when people come to you are unanswerable. Mm-hmm. Why did this happen? Mm-hmm. And am I going to get through it? Mm-hmm. I guess that second question is more up to them, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But how do you address that?
Well, the grieving journey is about creating a new normal. So getting folks to recognize that and also address and realize that this did happen. This happened. But now that it has happened, how do I create a new normal, a new sense of normalcy for myself and for my family in the absence of my family member not physically being present? And that's the grieving journey that we're talking about. That's first recognizing and acknowledging that it did happen, because a lot of people are still in shock. Mm-hmm. Going through the process of now that recognizing that it happened, what is it that I'm feeling? Why am I so tired? Why can't I get up in the morning? Kim and I often hear a lot from survivors, you know, I feel pain where my son got shot. How does grief manifest itself in your body? So recognizing those key triggers and then understanding, okay, this is part of the process. Now that it's part of the process, where do I go from here? And how do I still incorporate the beauty and the spirit of my loved one in my life, but how do I incorporate it in a very different way? A lot of my research talks about they're based upon what they experience. Some of the coping strategies they utilize to kind of venture through that journey are spiritual coping and meaning making, trying to make a sense, make meaning of that sense that Kim is talking about of the homicide.
I don't want to sure. hold on to the rest of what you want to say, but yeah. I want to zoom in on that phrase, meaning making. Mm. Because I think, again, that's a really, you pack a lot into those two words when you use it. And I mean, I guess most of us make meaning without actually consciously thinking of it. I mean, I guess we end up, as we move through life, having created some
right.
some sense of what's important and what means something to us.
Well, it's like what Kim said is, you know, the first question they ask is why? Mm-hmm. Why did this happen? So oftentimes, for example, I'll never forget one young man said to me, I had to believe that God needed another angel now, so young. I had to believe that that was the case as to why trying to rationalize why his cousin was murdered. You know, some people will basically say that, you know, God doesn't give you anything that you can't handle. Or on the opposite side of the spectrum, they're very, very angry with God. And so all of those things are pretty normal, but it's the passageway to trying to tease out how they can make meaning and sense of it. Would you mm-hmm. say so, Kim?
Yeah, it's how do you make sense of a senseless situation?
Exactly.
And so what kinds of answers do you try to give people, Kim?
Well, you know.
What kind of answers do you try to help them find?
Generally, when folks come in, they we try to come up with their goal, what it is that they want to get from the counseling session, and trying to get them to turn all those negatives into the positives, because it's really common for people to lean toward the anger, the hopelessness, and the helplessness. And so, and, you know, they also have a sense of not wanting to come to counseling again, because if they think that I'm going to try to make them get over this. Mm-hmm. And again, it really is helping to normalize a lot of what they're feeling and walk them through that. Okay, so there's no one answer for one person. It really is on an individual, what that person meant to them, what they hope to get out of the counseling experience, what they're looking for, even in terms of the whys. Because, again, making sense of a senseless situation, because no matter what, that person did not have the right to take another person's life. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about that why, you know, and again, it depends on where people are in their spirituality, because as Dr. Sharp mentioned, some people go from one spectrum to the other, you know, will be able to explain it away in their own spirituality. And then there's others who get really stuck and just are angry at God. And again, there is no way to explain this away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this idea that people are, some of the people at any rate that you come in contact with are afraid that there will be pressure to get over it, to move faster than they want to move. Is that common? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Imagine, if you will, your loved one has been murdered, taken away from you in a manner that you didn't even expect. It's not someone died of natural causes. Someone died because they were elderly. They had a long life that they've lived. But someone was suddenly taken away from you. You want to hold on to that memory, the love that you got from that loved one with your life. And so the mere thought that you would possibly go to someone who would say to you, you have to get over it now.
You have to move on.
Right? Mm-hmm. Is asking you to suddenly take those memories away. Take away the only thing that you have to hold on to make sure that person remains alive in your mind. And so that's really sort of the unique battle that Kim has a very amazing way of overcoming and connecting with survivors and letting them know that that's not the case. That what is your goal? Your goal may be, I need to get out of bed and make sure that I can go to work. And that's that one person's goal. The other person's goal may be, I need to be able to talk to my loved ones because I'm very angry with the fact that they weren't present for me during the murder and the grief that I had to go through of my son. So it differs. Mm-hmm. But that's mm-hmm. really the rationale behind that.
Professor Sharp, in your research, African Americans reported having a large informal support network, tended to be larger than the whites, mm-hmm. white people whom you talk to. Friends and family, but they were less likely to talk to those in that support network about what
mm-hmm.
happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why?
So again, going back to the uniqueness of homicide. so typically what you see is an individuals who are likely to, again, reach out with mental health services or participate in a survey, let's say, and talk about the homicide that they've experienced, are those individuals who are actually seen as the leader, if you will, in their family unit. So collective coping and caring has been well documented in that's the support system, if you will, that goes on in the African-American family. But when a homicide occurs, there's typically one or two people that kind of take the lead in making sure that the family has enough money to bury their loved one, has enough money to pay for a tombstone, has enough money to fly Aunt Betty, Uncle Jim in from North Carolina, South Carolina to attend the funeral. They're actually helping the other individuals in the family cope, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're taking this leadership status, but they're helping others cope, but they're not necessarily going to them to help with the coping that they need, helping with the grief and bereavement that they need.
But isn't this caring for the rest of the family a comfort for them?
It's a comfort for them. It's a comfort for them, but they reach a point where they too have anger about it. They too have to let it go in some way, shape, or form. So there's that dynamic that goes on, that there are usually typically individuals that are taking up, stepping up that role, but they're not necessarily accessing resources in the family for support. The other side of that coin is, as we, if we circle back to the conversation that we started this with, is that there's a tremendous ability or heavy reliance on informal support systems within the African American community because of that stigma of the availability, the perception of resources that will be available that will actually understand what I'm experiencing as an African American here. And so there's a heavy reliance on those informal networks, whether they be community, family, church networks, to that will understand what my cultural and social cultural process is through this grief journey. Does that make sense?
I think so. I'd love to hear from our listeners who have been through this about kind of what made sense to them as they went through us. You're welcome to send us an email at midday@wypr.org or to phone us at 410-662-8780. Let me pick up, Kim, on one particular set of points that Professor Sharp made about somebody in the family who sort of takes ownership of making sure that the resources are there, that people can get airfares if they need to come to a funeral, that there's money for a tombstone, money for a funeral. Are those things that the state's attorney's office, that the bereavement center in the state's attorney's office can help with?
Well, what we do, there is a federal program called VOCA, mm-hmm. Victims of Crime Act, through Criminal Injuries Compensation Board. We have those applications. It's an application mm-hmm. Process. And so we refer families to criminal injuries compensation when they are having difficulties with paying for the funeral. It's not an emergent fund. However, family members work with the funeral provider of their choice, and that funeral provider will work with them knowing that they've applied for this fund. It's up to $5,000 that will help. Also, the state's attorney's office does has a victim services unit that we also will be able to provide small amounts of emergency funds for family members who may have been displaced because of the homicide and may need cleanup services or may need to spend the night in a hotel for a night, or that type of thing. But everything would need to go through the victim's advocate, and we would do the assessment and see what that family's needs are.
Because I think many people, even with generous hearts, who hear about yet another homicide or read about it, don't think immediately of how this is complicating the finances of that family. I mean, obviously, money is in some ways the least of the loss, but it you write, Professor Sharp, about how the stresses brought by the homicide are on top of all the stresses a family already has mm-hmm. been coping with, mm-hmm. And it's not. I just wonder, Kim Holmes, how you're able to support families in that. You talked about specifically those mm-hmm. financial things, mm-hmm. but the overall mm-hmm. stress level.
Interestingly enough, you know, families, even though this is a tragedy, oftentimes families do come together around this tragedy, and resources have come to the family because of a person like Tanya, Dr. Sharp has mentioned, will take the lead. Oftentimes we get phone calls from family members mm-hmm. who were directly and indirectly impacted, but it's not always the immediate family member. It's mm-hmm. someone who's mm-hmm. taking that charge and will call and say, I need help with this and I need help with that. And sometimes we'll also go and get collections. They call the local churches. They call the local food banks. They do all of those things. And we also remind those family members to be able to take care of themselves, because what ends up happening a lot of times is when family members take the lead, mm-hmm. It's in their own denial and not wanting to have the impact be felt, you know, so strongly in themselves, so they start doing things to help and that also helps in their grief process. But I'm also mindful in reminding the families to be able to take care of themselves, because sometimes we could do so much busy work and we'll put what we call mask mm-hmm. on, and family members then will see that and take that as you're so strong, and the family member who was dealing with the homicide doesn't feel so strong. They're just feeling like they doing what they need to do to get through this.
Yes.
And so, and I oftentimes hear family members become angry because they feel like this one wasn't there for them, or this one didn't say the proper thing. And if they're looking at that person and thinking that that person is so strong, perhaps they think that person doesn't need it. And mm-hmm. that's what oftentimes happens and manifests that anger.
Mm-hmm. That is Kim Holmes, a licensed clinical social worker with the Family Bereavement Center out of the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City. And also with us is Associate Professor Tanya Sharp from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. We're going to take another short break and we'll be back quickly. If you lost a loved one to homicide, did you worry that people would judge the way they died? Did you seek out counseling, or did you rely on friends and family for support? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or give us a call at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about homicide and grief in the African-American community with Professor Tanya Sharp, Associate Professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Kim Holmes, a licensed clinical social worker at the Family Bereavement Center in the State's Attorney's Office of Baltimore City. And with you, if you call us at 410-662-8780. Chris has called us from Baltimore. Chris, welcome to Midday.
Hi, good day. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I want to make a comment. First, people grieve and go through a lot of stuff, even though they did not lose a loved one. My son, on his birthday earlier this year, he was coming to the house, and somebody was waiting under the porch. And as he got up the step, the person came out, pointed the gun to his head, fire and miss. He jumped over the porch and he kept running. And I was upstairs and I could hear the shots ringing out. The person emptied a gun behind him, but thank God it did not hit him. So I told him, you know, he had to leave, and he left the state of Maryland.
Oh, my.
So a few days after, I went outside on the block where the guys be at, and I told them, I said, listen, I don't know what it is, but he's not here anymore. I don't know what he did. And I will not be retaliating against anybody. So nobody should be thinking when they see me that I'm going to retaliate, because that's how everything escalates and more people keep dying. Mm. And every time I go to my house, it's like I feel so traumatized because I keep thinking somebody's going to be coming from under there, and it's be giving me major headaches, you know, and he's not even dead. So sometimes people lose a loved one, but some situations where somebody almost lose a loved one, they be going through the same thing too. And I think to prevent all of this, I think you need to have a topic about the sentencing for people who kill people, because it's a complete joke when you kill somebody, you literally get away with it. That's just fueling it. And the people who reporting, I think y'all need to do more. Because a lot of people listen to this station, and y'all need to do more to raise awareness that people need to be sentenced for a very long time as a deterrent. Not just worrying about the aftermath. You got to worry trying to stop it before it happens, so families and loved ones won't go through this.
Chris, I appreciate your call. You make a couple of good points. We're not going to get deeply into sentencing in this hour, but I know it's a topic that is going to be before the legislature this year, and we will have a chance to talk about it. But what about Chris's point that even if there hasn't been a murder, there can be the same kind of stress and part of the grieving process imposed on the community? Have either of you experienced that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the community violence that individuals experience does cause different or in a different array of trauma-like symptoms. The same sort of symptoms appear, hypervigilance, you know, living in fear, especially when you talk about concentrated areas where crime and violence is particularly paramount. And so what Chris is describing and experiencing is, you know, a manifestation of social toxicity in a lot of different, particularly urban neighborhoods. It is not... Not at all together unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kim? Okay. Let's talk to Marlon, who's calling us from Annapolis. Welcome to Midday, Marlon.
Yes.
You're on the air?
Yes. We lost our son 31 years ago due to suicide, and after going to Compassionate Friends Group, a parents' bereavement group in Baltimore, we live near the Bay Bridges. We decided to help start a group in Annapolis so we wouldn't have to travel so far. And there was a great need here in Annapolis. We had at times, in these last 30 years, we had at times 700 families and parents on our mailing list for our monthly newsletter. And we found in all this time that those of us that have been bereaved before, we handle all of the business activities, all of the... officers of the group, and we have not counseling groups, but sharing groups for the newly bereaved, especially, because what they need to do is talk and talk and talk until they get this terrible anger and grief out of themselves. And sometimes I remember saying the same thing at five different meetings. Nobody stopped me and said, you said that before. They listened carefully, and they offered what had helped them. Number two, counselors and hospitals and so forth need to be referring the bereaved families and parents to sharing, to such bereavement groups. Not just for counseling, because in counseling sessions, you never get enough chance to talk over and over again, and it takes a long time to get over this terrible grief you have, when, especially when somebody has been murdered or when there's a suicide. But even we found out parents have very similar grief when their children have died after long illnesses or whatever. So it's a long process.
Marlon, I appreciate your call. Let me take some of your points to our guests. Professor Sharp, I noticed you're taking a note. What is your comment?
Well, you know, I wanted to hone in on what Marilyn said in terms of the whole idea of screening. And I really, really think that the answer to addressing a lot of this or helping support individuals who are surviving this homicide violence and victimization is really through research, policy, and practice. And one of, I think, the policies that is fundamental to assisting individuals with helping individuals who are surviving the homicide of a loved one is the screening process. I think that she brings up a great point in terms of the fact that we're missing the mark if we're not asking the questions when parents and children come in for their health checks about what type of trauma and victimization they've experienced. We're missing the mark if we're not doing that when we're actually greeting children when they walk into our school systems and not asking about the trauma and victimization that they've experienced. Because if we don't start asking those questions, we're missing a whole opportunity to do an intervention, to assist with counseling services to help individuals navigate their way through trauma. And so I think that she's bringing up a great point in terms of the whole idea of screening.
I was struck by Marlon talked about the need to and I don't know whether I want to see how widespread you think this is, the need to say over and over, to talk over and over, to be for example in a group where you might be where you can just keep going through things until you've reached a point that it makes sense. We talked earlier, I think, about the extent to which African Americans bereaved by homicide often don't want to talk and share because of their fear of stigma. So does this just sort of stop them in their tracks?
Listen, the Family Bereavement Center has been around since 1990, and it came into existence for that very reason. Family members were feeling inundated by other family members because they were saying their stories over and over and over. And so family members felt like they needed some reprieve. And so hence the Family Bereavement Center. So in taking into consideration what Marlon said, there's an opportunity for family members to do both. We do individual, we have groups, okay? And so some family members are not ready, if you will, for groups because some family members are not able to hear other people's story. They're just barely able to tell their own story. And so when they come in, we do an assessment. We find out about other traumas, and we make sure that these traumas are not overlapping. And so that we can make sure that we refer them. If there's someone who has a history of domestic violence, have had another homicide and received no counseling and have not gone to any groups, then certainly you're going to hear all of that come out in individual. And so we tap into what their needs are and make sure that we refer them to the appropriate resource, whether it's group, whether it's individual, whether it's both.
And can I just add to once, and I've seen Kim do this, once you open that pressure valve of opportunity, that pressure valve of understanding, and you release it, I've seen it in terms of the fact that these homicide survivors don't want to leave the group. They want to continue to have those conversations.
And when you say remove the pressure valve, you mean make it clear that there's no stigma.
Make it clear there's no stigma. Make it clear that I am here welcoming you. It doesn't matter how long it's been since you've experienced the murder of your loved one. And it doesn't matter where you are in your journey, your grief journey. But here's a safe space for you to actually have a conversation and be understood and recognize that I'm not crazy, so to speak. Individuals don't want to leave. They don't want to stop having those conversations.
And again, is that good?
I think so. At least what it's saying in the research that I'm conducting in terms of the making meaning and maintaining a connection to the deceased is so important in the journey of grief to get to identifying what the new normal looks like for you. And so those sort of things are fundamental to that process.
Kim Holmes, we have just a minute or two left, and you mentioned earlier this time of year, heading into the holidays, can be especially troublesome. How do you address that?
Annually, the Family Bereavement Center and the state SAVE, which is Survivors Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE is a group of men and women who've lost a loved one to violence that have gone through the Family Bereavement Center, have decided that they will no longer allow their grief to keep them stuck and wanted to go out and do things and help others. So hence SAVE, Survivors Against Violence Everywhere. So every year together we have a program to honor their loved ones during this holiday, in which we have a tree and we ask every family member to bring their loved one's favorite dessert as well as an ornament in memory of their loved one. And we will have a ceremony where they will be able to place the ornament on the tree. We have a wonderful speaker, MC, who will be Lee Michaels, Reverend Lee Michaels, as well as our own state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. She will come and offer a few words as well to the families.
And that's next week, right?
Next Tuesday, December the 15th at City Hall.
And Kim, if people are looking to contact the Family Bereavement Center, how should they do that?
Please give us a call at 443-984-6244.
443-984-6244. We will put that on our website. I'm very grateful to both of you for this conversation.
Thank
Tanya Sharp, Associate Professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Kim Holmes of the Family Bereavement Center in Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And also grateful to our listeners. And tomorrow on Midday, Bird Stadium at the University of Maryland College Park may soon become Maryland Stadium. We'll take a look at the legacy of Harry Curly Byrd, who also did a lot for the University of Maryland but advocated for segregation. Is a name change in order? We'll be eager to hear from you. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Dronberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.